From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in September when Francis Haugen, a former Facebook employee, leaked company documents to the Wall Street Journal. These documents included extensive research about the mental health impacts that Instagram had on teenagers, particularly young women. For the past month, major news outlets, including the New York Times, have been citing the research as an example of the safety issues that Instagram poses to teenagers. In a March 2020 slide presentation reviewed by the Wall Street Journal, Facebook's researchers shared that 32% of teen girls said that when they felt bad about their bodies, Instagram made them feel worse. The report is not surprising to many teenage girls across the country. A 17-year-old from California, Eva Behrens, told the Wall Street Journal last month that every time I feel good about myself, I go over to Instagram, and then it all goes away. Lindsay Dubin, a 19-year-old, told the Journal that she recently wanted to exercise more, but after using Instagram to find workout videos, her feed was constantly populated with weight loss ads, diet plans, and photos of the ideal body type. Jonathan Haidt, the co-author of the best-selling book, The Coddling of the American Mind, told the Wall Street Journal that we're on the verge of a public health crisis tied to teenage social media usage. Facebook's own internal documents indicate that the company understands that Instagram makes body image worse for one out of three teen girls who use it. But the author and commentator Kat Rosenfield pushed back, writing for The Spectator, quote, "If you are or have ever been a teenage girl, the biggest surprise about all of this is that anyone finds it surprising at all. Making young women hate themselves has always been a highly lucrative business, and the only new thing here is the technology they're using to do it. What can bots or algorithms do when humans have always been like this? And what will break the cycle? Nothing less than a complete overhaul of the system by which we dispense social and cultural capital to women, which is to say that as long as society treats female beauty as currency, this phenomenon will be always with us in one form or another." End quote. On Tuesday, Senator Richard Blumenthal said that Zuckerberg and his executives were taking a page from the Big Tobacco playbook for hiding their research. But not all experts agree with that comparison. Candace Odgers, a researcher from the University of California, Irvine and Duke, told NPR earlier this week that, quote, "If you ask teens if they are addicted or harmed by social media or their phones, the vast majority say yes. But if you actually do the research and connect their usage to objective measures, there's very little to no connection," end quote. So is Instagram a unique threat to teenagers and young women in particular? Or is it just part of an ecosystem sending the wrong messages to kids about how they should value themselves? Our guests are here to explore these themes. And one of our guests is a senior at Mercy High School. Olivia Cross is in studio. Olivia, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Evan. Thank you for inviting me.
It's good to have you. It's good to have Jody Amon, a family therapist, and the author of Anxiety, I'm So Done With You. Jody, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
And Professor Harry Reese, a professor of psychology and Dean's Professor in Arts, Sciences, and Engineering at the University of Rochester, on the line with us. Professor, thanks for making time for the program. Let me start with Olivia Cross, who is a senior at Mercy High School. Olivia, can you give me a sense for your own experience with social media, and maybe how it's grown over time? When I say grown, whether your usage has increased, but also how your own views have evolved, particularly in the last year and a half.
So I think I'm coming at this from a very unique perspective, from a teenage standpoint, where I've basically, most of my social media feed is Instagram, very little on Snapchat, but my Instagram feed mostly consists of like professional athletes or people that correspond with like hobbies or interests that I have. I do not follow a lot of like influencers, but throughout the COVID pandemic and throughout the isolation and quarantine that's come with that, I think one of the points in the Wall Street Journal article that really stuck with me was how the Explore page affects teens and how it can really like teens can spiral down into that sense where it will continue to give you like targeted information on based on what you're interested in. And I noticed that like the lifestyle and the aesthetic and the beauty aesthetic, like pictures and videos, I mean, I think that has affected me throughout the pandemic, especially being so isolated, just the discrepancy between what you see on social media and what's actually going on in life, I mean, throughout isolation.
Can I ask you, would you describe yourself as addicted to Instagram or addicted to social media?
I mean, regretfully, I do think I am probably addicted to Instagram and social media. I notice that I do, you know, my interest peaks when I see a notification. My interest peaks when I see the icon in my app on my phone. And I do spend a fair amount of time on it. I'm not proud of that, though.
Well, no, and I want to stress that that one of the reasons we invited you is I think your experience is very much representative of what a lot of young women are experiencing on social. I also think you're admirably self-reflective about this. And I know that as much as you have kind of mixed feelings about it, you also have seen your peers be impacted even more than you have. And can you describe, you know, certainly not to name names, but generally speaking, when you think about the mental health compromise that some of your peers have experienced, what has that been like?
Well, I think that, I mean, Instagram particularly is very focused on the aesthetics. I mean, it was created for photography. I think it's kind of evolved into a, you know, like, focused on your body image. And I can totally see in my peers, and I can see like even in myself sometimes how, you know, it can easily lead to like the feed, the constant feed of those pictures and images, ideal lifestyles can easily, make somebody seek out medical help for it. I've witnessed, you know, friends and peers who struggle and make comments sidelining, you know, their body image, or it makes me sad. Yeah.
So when they are affected in particular about body image, what is driving the negative feelings that you, but especially maybe your peers of a similar age are feeling?
I think it's the constant feed. I mean, we're not away from our phones for very often. I mean, we're always connected with people. So I think the difference of Instagram versus just, you know, in history, like throughout, you know, life and comparing yourself in your body image, I think in recent times with the rise of Instagram and social media, it's constantly in our faces. I mean, even if you're not on Instagram, it's on TV or it's on YouTube. It's everywhere.
What do you think society has determined female beauty to be?
I think it's, right now, I think it's skinny, you know, it's healthy, whatever you may consider healthy to be. But I think in standards right now, healthy is to be skinny, and I don't agree with that. I think that's being shoved down our throats, that, you know, a healthy lifestyle, a perfect image of a person is to be skinny.
Mm-hmm. And there's I'm finding kind of a dissonance about one specific theme that maybe you can share your thoughts with Olivia, which is that your generation is coming into adulthood at a time when there is more conversation than ever about maybe clapping back against some of these really toxic ideas of a very narrowly defined beauty. Every time a magazine, to the extent there are magazines anymore, to be fair, but every time a magazine or every time there is an image editor who, you know, takes an inch off of a woman's thighs for a picture, or, you know, changes the way a woman looks in a shoot that ends up on a cover of a magazine. Every time that happens now, it's kind of a mini scandal, and probably appropriately so. So on one hand, you would think that we are arriving at a time where we are more aware than ever of how bad it is and how toxic and corrosive it can be, that all that stuff happens. And yet, what you are telling us is beauty remains very narrowly defined. It is defined with very specific and almost unattainable expectations for women's bodies. So how are these things happening when we're becoming more aware than ever of how dangerous that is and how unfair that is, versus how constant that message still is, especially to teenage girls?
In all honesty, I think there's a discrepancy between the users of the platforms, especially people within my generation. I think we kind of came up in a time where when we were turning 13, that's pretty much when Instagram came to fruition and we all joined it. And I think we're all kind of like growing almost with the social media platforms and their target base. So I think there's like a difference between the users, and I totally agree with your point that I think there's a lot of like people who are quote clapping back at the unattainable and unrealistic beauty standards that we see on social media. Yet I think there continues to be these unrealistic beauty standards being shoved down our throat through advertisements and algorithms that target their user base, which is in this case teen girls, mm-hmm. To spend more time on the platform, which it's a business, and it's not helping teenage girls.
Yeah, it's certainly a business. Last question for you, at least in this stretch, and then I want to turn to the other panelists. When we see this argument that Instagram is a unique threat, that we've never seen something quite like it, you've got on one side of this argument, Olivia, you've got people like Jonathan Haidt, who is a psychologist and the co-author of a book called The Coddling of the American Mind. He says that Instagram is a public health threat. A public health crisis is emerging among teenage girls because of this platform and because of social media. On the other side, you've got authors like Kat Rosenfield. She writes YA literature. She's a cultural commentator. And she says, sure, the platform can do damage, but the root of this is not a platform. It's the way we have always convinced girls and young women to compete on beauty standards, to view their beauty as currency, to narrowly define what beautiful means. And if you took Instagram away, you'd still have that. We always had that. So the focus is misplaced if it's just on the platforms. And I'm wondering sort of where you fall in that debate.
I completely agree that, I mean, throughout history, women have been taught to be competitive and in the beauty standards aspects. And I agree that if Instagram wasn't, or if it was taken away, that would still continue to be a problem. But I think the issue is that Instagram and social media is just such a new concept to us, mm-hmm. And that it is, it's accentuating the problem. I think it's just heightening and making it worse, just because of the accessibility we have to it and the way that it's designed to draw us in and make us addicted. Not saying if that's bad or good, it's just, that's the way it's designed. And I think it's just accentuating the problem.
I think that's a really wise way to describe it. And so Jody Amon, let me ask you a little bit about that. I mean, I've long hoped that we are, the optimist in me says that we're sort of still in the age of infancy with social media. And I think Olivia's generation is dealing with the most difficult challenge of it, because they are coming of age when this tool is now fully formed, right when they are coming into adolescence, teenage years, adulthood. And we haven't really figured out, can it do damage? How do we regulate it? How do we regulate ourselves? How do we use it appropriately? How do we know how to turn it off? And I think everything Olivia just described is profound to me, because it is wise, but it's also recognizing she still uses it. I mean, it's difficult. There's a real pull for this kind of a tool. Are you optimistic, Jody, that we eventually will regulate whether I'm talking about Facebook or Instagram regulating it or outside regulators, or even just the way we use it and teach ourselves to use it and not use it?
Well, that's interesting. It seems like we'd have to monetize that clapback somehow because, you know, the reason why that it's still happening with this clapback going on about toxic masculinity and the gays and all that is because those things don't make money. And the advertising by getting the attention, by promoting these high standards is a moneymaker. So we really have to do something on that level of having that other way of thinking about ourselves, that understanding that this is what's happening, and let's really look at it and analyze it. We should be doing that in school, and I think they're starting to. Actually, I'm starting to work on a curriculum for a healthcare class because we really, if we understood what was happening, then we could make some more choices and have some more agency in the matter. Right now, it's a little bit passive. And then you add the pandemic on top of that with so much time, the hours on social media multiplied exponentially the last year and a half.
I'm really glad to hear you talk about education and what students are going to be learning about this, Jody. That was in my notes for later this hour, but let's kind of go there now as you raise it. When do you think students at what age should start learning about social media? And I mean not just what it is, how to use it, but also some of what we are starting to see, whether it's, yes, the internal documents that Facebook acknowledging some of the negative or corrosive impacts, whether it's psychological research, studies, et cetera. When do we start teaching that and how do we do that?
Yeah, I think that we need to do that research so that, you know, the APA could come out and let parents know what the standards are, what, you know, this generation, Generation Z, the way that they're defined is they've had a smartphone, they've had access to the internet in their hands since at least seventh grade. So this is the first generation has ever had that access that early, and that makes a huge difference. Some of the research that's already coming out, and I'm sorry, I can't refer to any specific ones, but is that it is affecting the brain. And so if we get that message out more and more, and then parents could help, it could help parents and kids make those decisions. But with teenagers, they have to know the why before they really agree to limiting something that they like so much. They really have to see the benefit to them to balancing their life a little bit more. You know, we see people who are passive recipients of all of that, and actually that's even worse. If someone's actually creating content, if it's funny or they're making reels or they're making something, that's actually better for the brain. And what's really happening is that our brain has evolved for 2 million years to solve problems. And if we're passively watching stuff and just seeing things, it doesn't have enough to solve, so it starts to create some. And that's where this, so we have this comparison standards in our society, but also we have these brains that really want to do something. And so that's the easiest thing for us to grab is like, how could I be more perfect? Or how could I be better or enough or smart enough, pretty enough, thin enough, you know, you name it.
Professor Harry Reese was part of a research team on a paper published in Child Development in 2020 titled "Getting Fewer Likes Than Others on Social Media Elicits Emotional Distress Among Victimized Adolescents." Professor, what did you find there?
Well, what we found in that study was that even something as benign as not getting likes was disturbing, particularly to adolescents who were prone to depression, prone to anxiety, prone to having emotional difficulties. And, you know, there was nothing critical in the information we gave. We simply gave more likes to other people than to those adolescents, and they experienced that as harmful.
And harmful in what way? I mean, how do you define harm?
The way we defined harm in the research was that they simply ended up more depressed, more anxious, and they felt rejected by their peers, which of course is a very common experience that adolescents have in their everyday lives. But what's important about this research is that This wasn't just everybody, that this was picking up on predispositions that these individuals had. So if you're at all leaning in that direction, as many adolescents are, the experiences of not getting likes really pushed people over the edge.
And Professor, as I think about this debate, kind of the debate between people like Jonathan Haidt and Kat Rosenfield, I think Kat Rosenfield's writing on this has been a very, very important service to remind us that we can't just be concerned about a platform. We have to be concerned about all of the reasons that we are teaching the wrong lessons, or society is sort of embedding in it this idea that girls and young women are only going to be valued for beauty. Beauty is narrowly defined. I mean, that is well taken. The concern that I think Dr. Haidt raises, Professor Reese, is that if you look at the rise in suicide ideation, reported depression, mental health problems beyond depression, and track it to the rise of just Instagram, it's close to a match. I mean, it's really remarkable. And I think the point he's making is, yes, we've got to worry about the fundamentals that lead to this. However, this tool itself is like putting a weapon in kids' hands, and they may not realize it. And, you know, we're going to lose kids to this. It's going to be really, really dangerous if we don't arrest some of these trends, however we're going to do that. Do you agree with that concern at that level?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the adolescents' concern about being attractive, adolescents' concern about what others of their peers are doing, there's nothing new to that. That's been going on for millennia. What's new is the power and scope that this information comes across. All of a sudden, you can find out not what the kid down the block is doing, but all of a sudden you can find out what hundreds of people are doing. And the images that are coming across are architected by professionals who know how to make them particularly dramatic, particularly striking. And so you're taking an individual who's at a vulnerable stage of life, and you're hitting them over the head with a hammer. So it's not that the concerns are new, it's that the potency with which this is going on is so much more powerful than it ever was.
Well, let me ask all three of our guests about one other aspect of this, and then we will turn it over to listeners who may have some thoughts to share. If you want to call the program, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. Excuse me, it's 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. As we discuss what Facebook and Instagram have admitted they know about the corrosive nature of the platform, about how much damage it does, particularly for teenage girls, body image, mental health, depression, and more, and what, if anything, ought to be done about it, whether it's the platform itself, what's the way we teach it, the way we expect teenagers to engage with it, and the breaks we need from it, we'd love to hear from you. But one of the things that stands out, and let me turn back to Olivia, who's a student at Mercy, there's this idea, Olivia, that Professor Reese and the things that Jody Amon are sharing, and the things that Facebook has admitted, if only teenagers knew this, well, we could really curb some of the damage here. But as Kat Rosenfield writes, teenagers are pretty aware. They know that this can be a problem. And if you ask them, there's a lot of conflicting ideas. They'll tell you, yeah, it's probably bad for me. And yeah, I don't want you to take it away. I like it. Or I want to keep using it. It's a complex set of ideas here. Is there any sort of a strategy that you see, Olivia, that would convince large percentages, especially of teen girls, but people in general, to maybe use a lot less of these platforms or not use them at all?
Yeah, so I think that the problem here is maybe not like how much time we're using it. It's more of like how we're using it, how we're interacting with the social media platforms. And I think, there's probably not one person that I have talked to that has never heard of this, like social media and it being and having having negative effects on you. So I completely agree that like a broad range of teenagers are very aware, or at least somewhat aware, of the implications that their, you know, screen time and especially social media time can have on them. Maybe not to the extent of, you know, how it can affect them in their minds, but at least from the emotional or psychological standpoint. But I think probably one of the best things we could do right now is just education. I mean, just at least learning and talking and communicating about how we can better craft our time on social media to be a beneficiary to our well-being and to our mental health. I mean, I don't know if it's the platform's responsibility or if it's the user's responsibility, because we kind of are the product of the social media. But I think the biggest thing here is just how do we change how we're interacting with social media and our mindsets about it, our perspectives about it.
Start that education how young, Olivia?
I mean, I think that the self-love and the body image talk can start in grade school, probably not in the context of social media, but at least, you know, making children aware, and all the way up until their adolescence and, you know, 18 or whatever, of how they can, you know, manage this ever-changing world and climate of social interaction online.
I suspect Jody Amon is nodding right along with that, that you can't wait until they're already using the platform, right? I mean, start early.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So, you know, even adults, you know something's bad for you and you keep doing it. I mean, we're just all like that. We think, oh, we'll get better later. You know, so why do we expect teens to do something that we're not doing? And so I think the focus really needs to be on what the alternative is. You know, how do they get involved in something creative, or how do they get involved in something outside that, that is, you know, using their brain in different ways, connecting with people in different ways, highlighting some of that stuff. Unfortunately, the last year and a half, they lost a lot of that. So, you know, I kind of stopped talking about we need to get off the phone, because that's all they had for connection. They needed it at that time. But doing some creative things. Our brain needs creativity. So what happens is so many messages are coming from here that they're telling us we're out of control and we're powerless. And so we need to balance that time with doing things that make us connect with our own self-efficacy, make us see that we have power, we have skills. And so we need to make sure that's really balanced. And that would make a difference. And I'm saying maybe sixth, seventh grade, that's thinking that they're on their smartphones from that age. But unfortunately, a lot of people are from even younger. So I would start, but the concept development, you know, in sixth, seventh grade to really understand, that might be a place to start. And start, you could start having kids be connected with their own agency as a in a very early age, but teaching them the hazards, as I think it's important, and having them see the hazards and knowing what the alternatives are, so that there's a bit of a balance. Like, phones are not going away. We're going to keep having them for a long time. Social media, it'll change to something else. I mean, a couple of years ago, it was Musical.ly that was really damaging a lot of girls, or I think that's the right name of it, but I'm aging myself. But yeah, so I think that's what I, you know, when you ask for what grade, I say sixth, seventh grade, because kids are getting phones that young. And sometimes younger.
Yeah. And Professor Reese, last question for you, then we'll turn it over to the phones after we take our only break of the hour. On the subject of understanding usage, I now think of Instagram in the same way, strange comparison here, that I've been thinking about COVID. We're not going to COVID zero. We're going to figure out a way as a society to live as safely as we can with it. I mean, Instagram's not going away, or at least some version of its ilk will always probably be there until we collide with the sun. And so how do we know what real addiction is versus I'm probably overusing it, or, you know, I should probably pick up a book or go outside? I mean, how do we know when there's a real distressing relationship with that, whether it's an adult or a child?
Well, we know there's a real distressing relationship when people can't resist doing something that they know is bad for them. Just like the alcoholic who can't resist taking a drink, even though he or she knows that it's going to be problematic, when an adolescent can't resist looking at these things on their phone, even though they are aware that it's going to be difficult, then we know that we have an addiction problem.
Mm. And often we do, right? I mean, do you think most people could diagnose their own addiction to this?
No, most people can't diagnose their addiction to it. Apple figured that out when they started sending people notifications every week about what their screen time was, and people went, oh, my God, I had that much? You know, people are not aware of the extent to which this can be a problem. One of the best ways people can experiment with that is to try and experiment. Don't use your phone for 24 hours. See how it see how that feels. And I suspect most people would go through withdrawal symptoms in the same way that they would go through withdrawal if they didn't have their coffee or they didn't have their drinks.
Professor, my 9-year-old had to go to a Pokemon Go party on Sunday, and he needed my phone to play the game. And I had to go to a work event, and so he had my phone. And it was like going back in time, and it was fabulous. I survived it. But I suspect that brief respite for a few hours, I might have started to get twitchy if it had gone into the overnight hours of the next day. But the professor's right. I mean, how long could we go before we feel like we are not able to function? And what would that would reveal about ourselves? I think it's fascinating. We're talking about what Instagram knows about the damage that this platform does. Of course, Facebook owns Instagram, and documents released in the last month indicate that the company is aware that huge numbers, I mean, we're talking a third of teenage girls who use Instagram report that it damages their body image, and Instagram knows it. Facebook knows it. Large numbers. We're talking a quarter, a third of users, especially teenage users, and usually girls, report that their mental health suffers when they use it. They use it anyway. Facebook knows it. So what do we do with that? We're talking to Olivia Cross, a senior at Mercy High School, Jody Amon, a family therapist and the author of Anxiety, I'm So Done With You, and Harry Reese, a professor of psychology and the Dean's Professor in Arts, Sciences, and Engineering at the University of Rochester. Your phone calls after this only break of the hour. Coming up in our second hour, we're going to stay on the social media theme, and we turn our attention to the Facebook whistleblower. You'll meet a woman who also worked for Facebook next hour. She was a fact checker, and she had similar concerns about the platform and the damage it was doing. And she left Facebook. We'll talk about why, what she learned, and what we can do about all of this going forward. What we should expect social media platforms to do, but what we do ourselves. That next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let's go to some of your phone calls and feedback. In Canisius, this is Michael on the phone. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. Do we have Michael, guys?
Hello?
There you are. I heard you there, Michael. Let's try it again. Can you hear me, Michael?
Okay. Yes.
Yep, go ahead.
My question is for any of the panelists who want to field it. So, you know, for generations, you know, our parents told us, you know, don't watch too much TV, go out and play with your friends, you need exercise. And then they came to, you know, you can't spend too much time on the computer games, et cetera, et cetera. So that's always going to be there, I guess. You know, our own experiences and my experience as a kid and as a parent has been that kids will find a way to use whatever, no matter what. So I guess my question is, and I totally agree with the educational portion of it, you know, give the kids the knowledge that, you know, here's what it does, here's what the benefit is and all that. But what, you know, in light of the recent whistleblower hearings and all that, what role do we see as like a media or like, I don't know, like analogous to an FCC or something, kind of a regulation for these types of platforms? I guess best case scenario, what would the panelists foresee coming out of those hearings or coming out of any regulatory body?
Yeah, good questions. Yeah, thank you, Michael. Let me go to Professor Reese first on that. Professor, go ahead.
Regulations are, of course, a tricky kind of problem. We bristle about regulations in this country anytime anyone puts regulations on us. But the big problem, as I see it, is the kind of algorithms that are being used to send these messages to adolescents. And there needs to be some kind of control over what kind of messages you can send, over what kind of content is allowed, you know, in the same way that we regulate pornographic images and how that, you know, who they can be sent to and who can have access to them. We could regulate the dissemination of weight control materials, for example. So I would think that one of the places to start would be to regulate what kind of messages could be sent to people of a certain age.
Jody Amon, how do you feel about that, the challenge of regulation and some of the themes that Michael raised?
Thanks, Dan. Okay. Sorry, my mic was off. I think that people don't put their real birth date in social media, to be honest, and so that will not do what it's meant to do. I think this is a great idea, and I think a lot of times parents have to be looking at their kids' phones all the time to be testing as well, because, you know, we have to take that control back. I'm a mom too, and so we have to do that because we can't expect anyone else to do that for us. And yes, that'd be great if there was those regulations, but it's too easy to put a different birth date in. I don't know how you'd keep that from really doing what it's supposed to do.
Olivia, do you think there's a way of regulating social media that is consistent and fair and smart that isn't being done right now, or is this mostly up to us?
You know, I think there's some responsibility on the platforms to regulate how they're targeting their audiences and how heavily they're targeting specific audiences. But I agree that, you know, it's so easy to for the user to manipulate data that's inconsistent with reality to better, you know, to feed their interests. So I think it's a mixture of both.
Let me get from Tashonda in Rochester. Tashonda writes, the images portrayed on social media are dangerous, not just young girls, but for women as well. And for example, the snapback after having a baby is insanely dangerous, and I wouldn't be surprised if it plays a part on postpartum depression for some moms. That's from Tashonda. Jody Amon, what do you think of that?
Yeah, when we see that other people are doing something and we think that's how it's supposed to be done, like that there is some standard. First of all, there is no standard. Everybody is totally different, and how people recover from after having a birth is completely different for that person. There's so many different factors involved in that. And so if you think that you're wrong, this is the thing. People don't want to be different, right? We really want to belong. And so if there's any message in any way, shape, or form making us feel like we're outside the norm, then we feel like something's wrong with us, and that's really corrosive on our sense of ourselves. And so that's what these things are playing on. You could use any content, but it's the same thing. If it's like, I'm not doing what is the right way or the best way or the coolest way, then you're outside. And that's really the problem. It doesn't matter what kind of thing it is.
Yeah. You know, Olivia, I'm looking at the most dangerous Instagram memes, and some of it is just the kind of stuff that sadly, you know, in the last decade, about a dozen people have been killed, fallen off buildings or bridges because they're trying to do dangerous photography and post them on Instagram. I mean, that's kind of the outlandish stuff that's really wild. But when we mean dangerous, we're also talking about the things that Tashonda wrote about. You know, the idea that, hey, mom, you just had a baby, but in 2 months you can be a size zero again, and things like that, that encourage this, exactly what Jody just described. Olivia, what do you see? Are there trends or kind of memes, subgenres that you see on social media that are particularly concerning to you?
Well, I definitely think that social media has played a role in our ideas of reality. I think that especially like face filters have played a role in distorting our perception of reality. I mean, even so, I noticed that on Instagram, they show at the bottom of the screen if you're using a face filter, but it's still that image that's going to stick in your mind. It's still that image that you're going to think back to. And I definitely agree that there's a lot of sub, like, genres amongst social media where your perception of reality is completely skewed based on only the few that are posting their highlight reels, only the few that are posting their bests. I think there's definitely a genre of that, or the form of that, for every like age group or every demographic, at least the ones that are using the given platform. I can't think of anything in particular, but I would say that there's definitely that form of, you know, deformed reality, and based on only a few individuals' highlight reels, is present throughout all the users.
And let me push on that idea with you a little bit more, Olivia. When you talk about the filters and the way we alter the images, even if people know they've been altered, you're still trying to project a certain thing. In the last 5 years, we've seen a lot more stories of, I guess you would call them social media influencers, people who have a lot of followers, and they became sort of insta-famous when they would post these, you know, sort of down-home pictures where they're not all made up, they're just sort of doing normal life. And then what happens is, inevitably, they sort of, you're going to end up seeing a post where they say, guys, I've wanted you to think that this is just, I'm just being real, but every one of the pictures that gets posted, we took 1,000 pictures, we edited, we filtered, just to try to make it look normal and not look touched up. And I mean, that stuff happens all the time. I'm sure you've seen that, Olivia. And yet, my guess is we've all posted in ways that are super careful of how the image was taken, what angle it was taken from, what's my good side, what's the light, like, can I use this filter, can I edit it? Even though we know that people end up miserable, even people who've been famous for that. Do those things stand out to you? Do you think about, Olivia, like, do you think about that dissonance that we're trying to make it look to the world like, oh, this is just me, I'm just hanging out, where the reality is even those photos are often super, super touched up or edited?
Yeah, I mean, I think that just our mindsets overall around social media kind of encourage us almost to jump to conclusions very quickly, to always want that constant, the constant enthrall with like how many likes or that immediate satisfaction. I think also comes with our instant judgments of images and words, and we're completely like jumping to conclusions most of the time, never really stopping to question and think, you know, what's really happening behind the camera. And I completely agree that there's a vast variety of influencers on social media that portray these incredible lifestyles and then come to find out later on that it's unrealistic. But I think in its design, I think we're all kind of jumping to conclusions. And I think that could also tie back into the education piece of this, is mm-hmm. how do we learn to question and to, you know, think about what we're really witnessing?
That's a great question. And the other thing that stands out to me, Professor Reese, is that if we want to take a look at these Instagram memes, whether it's the snapback moms who are a size zero 2 months after giving birth, or just the notion of size zeros or twos or whatever, and this narrowly defined beauty, excuse me, it strikes me, Professor, that it wasn't that long ago in human history when fuller figured women were, that was the beauty standard, that was more of the norm. And so some of that has been a cultural change. I don't think you can regulate away, as you've said, some of the most corrosive parts of this. So how does the culture move on this?
Well, let me just point out first, Evan, that the problems we're talking about are not unique to women. The same kinds of issues apply to men also. For example, on Instagram, you get inundated, if you're an older male, with hormones and pills that are designed to help you build muscles, prevent the decaying of the body, take additional testosterone, which we know is dangerous for older men to take. We know that Instagram encourages younger men to do risky things like the milk crate challenge, to excessive drinking. So these kinds of things go on just as prevalently for men in our culture as well as for women.
But is there a way that, that culture sort of moves, or are we sort of powerless on this?
Oh, no, culture definitely moves. Culture has moved throughout historical time. I think, you know, you're absolutely right in saying that beauty has always been something that society has emphasized in women. The standard of what is beautiful has changed dramatically, and that standard is influenced by cultural values. It's influenced by the environment that we live in. So, you know, in the Western world, where childbirth is, for the most part, not a risky activity anymore, standards of thinness have become more prevalent. If you go to parts of the world where childbirth is far riskier, you find that greater body weight is associated with being attractive. The cultural standards respond to what's going on in the environment at that time.
Writing to the program, Scott says, you should let your kids go on Instagram only if you also believe they should ride a bike with their eyes closed. Ricky writes to say, I'm starting to think kids before adulthood should never be allowed on Instagram. But I mean, once the YouTube seal gets broken, who are we even kidding? That's an interesting point from Ricky, because YouTube is its own sort of issue. YouTube has tried to take its own steps to sort of moderate or regulate. But Olivia, how much time are your peers spending on YouTube, and do you see that as an issue?
In all honesty, I don't see as much of a problem with YouTube, more just because of its design. It's more focused on longer videos, tutorials, you know, entertaining videos, what have you. And I think that it may be equally used to other social media platforms, but I don't see the I don't personally see the mental health effects as drastic on YouTube as that of Instagram.
Let me close by asking, we've been focusing on all of the risks and dangers. Let me just close by asking all three of you just briefly if you see positives from it. Olivia, do you get positive interaction with Instagram and social media that you can describe?
I mean, yes. In my experience, Instagram, I've kind of always used it as a tool more over to compare myself, but or not to compare myself, but moreover to, you know, connect with my specific interests, sports, hobbies, professionals, usually verified accounts, you know, news. So I usually get a lot of information from that. I also am able to connect with peers, especially during isolated times like COVID. It's been a great tool for me personally to organize and learn from my peers and grow. But that's the particular way I use it. And I know it's a little bit out of the ordinary.
Okay. Jody Amon, do you see positive benefits here?
Yeah, of course there are some positive benefits. There's some inspiration, connections happening. I have a couple hundred videos on YouTube. Most of my comments are from teenagers. And so they are using YouTube as looking for tutorials, looking for skills or way to do stuff. That is a neat thing that about the internet, right? We could Google and find out any information that we want to find. That's actually good for the brain, and that's actually connecting people with our agency. So there are some definite positives in there. People who are creating content, if it's you know, if it's those building skills or doing something fun or funny or entertaining, then that is actually good for them and good for their brain. And so there is some positives that I do see out there.
Okay. And Professor Reese, about 30 seconds, what do you see?
Maintaining connections with friends and family who are not in the same community as you are is unquestionably a major positive.
Probably the only one. I'm kidding. I'm with you there. In fact, I have been connected to family and friends all across the country in good times and bad. And sometimes when there's struggles and issues, and it's nice to still be connected that way. Hopefully there's a lot that we will still be able to take with us as we go forward. But I hope we've learned a lot this hour. And I just want to say, Olivia Cross, senior at Mercy High School, I'm grateful for your time and your insight. And now I know why your peers are so impressed with you. They recommended you for this program. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Evan, for having me.
You got it. Jodi Amon, a family therapist, author of Anxiety. I'm so done with you. Where are you online, Jodi Amon?
JodiAmon.com, JodiAmon.com.
Thank you for being with us as always, Jodi. Nice having you.
Thank you.
And Professor Harry Reese from the University of Rochester, thanks for sharing not only your research, but the insight, Professor. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
A short break and more connections is coming up.